Greetings, fellow amateurs, and welcome to another episode of the Amateur Society. My name is Steven, and I'm pleased to have with me once again my good friend and brother in Christ, Ross Powell. How are you doing, Ross?
Great, Steven. Thank you for having me on again. It's great to be here with you.
Awesome. So I think we'll start with a brief rundown of where you see things in terms of the general political state of affairs. Certainly after the election, there's been buzz on a wide variety of different issues and a lot of turnover in terms of media narratives, whether it's obsolete media or independent media, fake news claims, recounts, threats to electors, all sorts of things seemingly up in the air. Meanwhile, the Trump train rolls on, picking up new cabinet appointments and everything else. It's a complicated landscape out there, Ross, but how do you see it?
I think we're still in a state of flux. I mean, I think the folks that lost are still renting their garments over the fact that Trump's going to be president, and they're trying every way they can to derail that, but it's a fool's errand. He's going to be president for at least 4 years, maybe eight. There's rumors that Hillary may run again in 2020. We thought that she had been dispatched, but apparently not. The other political arena is you have Trump is nominating a bunch of folks up for his cabinet. Again, they have to be approved by the Senate. But so one of the controversial ones, I think, from his electorate was the new Treasury Secretary, who was a former Goldman Sachs person and really a key member of the swamp that he was going to drain. So I don't know whether the swamp is draining into the White House or vice versa. But that was a big one. And then Wilbur Ross in commerce, Cho in education, I'm sorry, transportation, excuse me. So, and then the fact that there could be Romney as the Secretary of State is really interesting, considering the vitriol that he spewed out during the election. So it's curious to see where Trump is really going to go with his cabinet now, because it's a hodgepodge of people that most of the folks that voted for him would not have expected him to nominate. Now, recognizing you can't go in with a lightsaber and slice the whole establishment apart. So I think he's playing good in the sandbox at this point just to get himself in there. And once the inauguration has passed, perhaps he'll start pushing some of the things that he talked about. And I think his Treasury Secretary, Mnuchin, I believe is his name, is talking about some good things about reducing taxes and things of that nature. So we're a state of flux and transition, and I think people are still shell-shocked about the case with Trump being in the White House.
Yeah, it's certainly a complicated scenario, and it leads to plenty of day-to-day speculation about the ins and the outs of what's going to happen, what's going on, who are these people that he's talking to or even appointing. Did you refer to Steve Mnuchin as Mnuchin? I think that's a pretty good moniker for him. It's got it, buddy.
It's Mnuchin. Yeah, I'm sorry, Mnuchin.
It's a little bit tough. Whenever your name starts with an MN, it gets a little bit tricky for me. Okay. He was involved deeply with the Trump campaign, so it's difficult to get anywhere or do anything in finance without having some dealings with the bank known as the Vampire Squid or any of these other kind of institutions. And Trump certainly does have that experience, but people are certainly of a mindset to question these kind of appointments. In terms of my perspective, I generally have been sitting back and letting things play out before I rush to judgment this way or that. I think it certainly would be a significant signal if Mitt Romney gets the Secretary of State appointment, but ultimately, I think there is a lot of back room and behind the scenes wheeling and dealing going on, because we have to take care of getting through the inauguration first, and then it might be a different scenario. So it's challenging for me to speculate, really, but with those obstacles to the inauguration in mind, what do you think about the back and forth between the recount efforts and judges coming out and denying things, this, that, and the other? Is that just all a wild goose chase? Is it for some other reason? Why do you think that's all going down the way it is?
Number one, I think Jill Stein is trying to get herself in graces with the Democrats at some level and feather her nest, at, both financially as well as through her network of folks. Also, I think there's just many people just can't grasp the fact that Trump's going to, has won, and they're trying everything they can to, again, as I mentioned earlier, to refute that. But I think many ways, if they get it to the point where it's a contested election, and Congress has to decide. Well, it's a fully controlled Republican Congress in both houses, and so that it would be a fait accompli that Trump would be the winner. But I think they would always put that in people's mind that this election was not legitimate, and people, he's not really your president. So again, it just steals their wool that they were going to still be up against in the regime that they don't like, and they're going to do everything they can. I mean, talk about death threats to electors. There's a story on InfoWars this morning that 15 of them are talking about not voting for Trump. And then I saw stories that 8 aren't going to vote for Hillary. Then another 6 in Colorado aren't going to vote for Hillary. So you have all of this back and forth, and it's just people gnashing their teeth thinking because they didn't get what they wanted. And again, it's just, I guess just because you in national politics, not everybody gets a trophy like they probably grew up with. And this generation is used to getting their way. And if they don't get it, they try every conniving way to get around it. They just can't face the fact that this is, you lost, he won. Just let's move on, and as he's trying to do, build bridges back to each other and move ahead. But I don't know that there's people on the left and the right that don't want to build bridges. They want to have a civil war. There's a lot of talk about, I think we are in a state of de facto civil war from a cultural perspective, but live shooting hasn't started yet, and I'm hoping that never does. But there are people at both ends of the spectrum that would love to see some type of violence to ensue.
Certainly, and I think you hear reports of all sorts of different, even secessionist movements in various places, in various states, and a lot of it can be written off as just white noise and an overly emotional response to something that people aren't in favor of in terms of the election results. However, there is some significant organization and resources that are being deployed behind these sorts of efforts. However, ultimately, I think a lot of people are upset and a lot of people are out a whole lot of money because there were plenty of massive contributions from people. And even though you have deep pockets, it's got to sting when you drop a few billion dollars into something and don't get the return on the investment that you were looking to.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're looking at California and Jerry Brown and a bunch of folks in that state are trying to get a secessionist movement going on. I mean, Texas talked about it for years, and they always called us crazy for talking like that, and now they're doing the exact same thing, but they see it's legitimate because of their concerns. So it's just a hypocrisy that just blows me away on the way the folks on the left are doing things these days, and they just can't get past that they lost, and because they had groupthink going on for years, thinking, well, Hillary was a shoo-in. When they didn't get what they wanted, they can't manage it. Their cognitive dissonance just cannot manage it. So where we go from here is we just have to give it some time. And I think what you're doing is waiting out and seeing if everything plays out is a good place to be. Keep your powder dry, don't make any rash judgments, and just see where the proof's in the pudding, where they actually take the country starting in January 20th, and what are the first things they do out of the gate. But I think Trump has the audacity enough to do some things immediately on the 20th and 21st, and as he's sworn in, he may have executive orders destroying all kinds of things that Obama has done. And Obama's in denial of what really caused the election results. He's blaming Fox News. I saw a story. He's blaming Fox News in every bar and every restaurant causing the problem. Not looking at his narcissism doesn't allow him to look at his own failures. So it should be an interesting through December and Christmas and into early January. It should be an interesting time because I'm sure we're going to see the pendulum swing both ways of what's going on in the country.
I think with regard to the Electoral College, at least, all of the different shenanigans about recounts and everything else and the sort of different political machinations and the levers that can get pulled, I think a lot of it is just simply a fool's errand. Kind of like the fool's errand of labeling anything that's anti-globalist or anti-establishment fake news. I think that that's going to completely backfire, and it's been sort of hoisted out there in a couple different ways. Clearly just a rush job to cover up for a particular narrative. What do you think?
Yeah, I know. That's just hysterical. I mean, look at the name of the sites that they call Russian propagandists or what they call useful idiots. Drudge Report, the largest website news aggregator in the world with the most hits of anybody, and it's a Russian agent or a Russian useful idiot. That's just ridiculous. Zero Hedge, some of the best analysis comes through there. You have, I mean, it's the who's who of the right-wing politics.
Yeah, I definitely think that we see the kind of message control that betrays the same kind of playbook where you isolate your opponent, you marginalize them, you name call, and you yell as loud as possible, and you don't tolerate any opposing position. However, I think the game has changed here in that people are able to easily recognize that the lists that are either created by assistant professors at random universities or by an anonymous group that simply makes these kind of declarations ad hoc. It's all just a bunch of nonsense. It's a total smokescreen. There's no real investigatory journalism or any attempt to, from what I've heard, contact any of these people to get any particular side of the story. It's simply a manipulation and a narrative control mechanism that I think is going to backfire because it's so easily disputed and refuted, and it's so patently ridiculous that it can only be seen by anyone who's half conscious as a desperate attempt to cover tracks and explain away something in terms of the election results that is inexplicable. So it must be this, it must be that. Look at what's happening. Oh, the Russians. It's just ridiculous. It's crazy. Meanwhile, over in Syria, the Russians and the Syrian army are well on their way to liberating Aleppo from ISIS and the rest of the militants over there. So, you know, you have to really look at the true state of affairs. If people are still buying the narrative that, oh, you know, Russia hacked the elections or this, that, and the other thing, it's time to grow up, and I think we're getting there as a country. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to come along without some significant protest in terms of kicking or screaming or, God forbid, something even more dramatic, but clearly, we're in a position where people don't trust the obsolete media outlets, and they're looking for real truth, and the truth is actually out there.
Oh, agreed. I mean, this whole fake news thing is just a form of McCarthyism at a certain level. It's a witch hunt saying, well, you don't follow the party line, and these guys on the left, Joseph Goebbels would be proud of them. I mean, some of the stuff that they put out is unbelievable. And it's complete half-truths and false information, but they turn around and saying the folks that disagree with the globalist agenda are the ones with the fake news and they're useful idiots. And you look at, and you have going on in Syria with Aleppo being freed, and it's Russians freeing the Syrians from the American proxies known as ISIS, and NATO proxies known as ISIS. And so you have now Turks going in there or fighting in there now, and Israel's making flights over Syria also. So how do you, everybody's talking about the election, but there's really a geopolitical situation. And Syria is just could end up going to World War III, and we thought we ratcheted it down with Trump being elected because Hillary was going to put a no-fly zone over it. And I did see a story that the House did pass a measure, and I didn't read the whole story, but they passed a measure to set up a no-fly zone in Syria, but I haven't been able to confirm that. So all of these things with the Russians, and it seems like we're just constantly poking them in the eye, is what's the whole point of all that? Putin's said numerous times he wants to work with the Trump administration. He's ready to normalize relations again. And yet we still see all these things in the mainstream press about, oh, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming, while they're actually being Stalinesque in their own way that they're controlling the news or trying to control the news and feed us this pabulum of war. That is just unacceptable because it's just not there, and they're trying to stir this up. And I guess it's neocons and inside the current administration that are still trying to ratchet up these wars because that's how they make their money. And there's numerous books out on that. It's War is a Racket. It's by General Smedley D. Butler, and he just basically talks about the whole military-industrial complex and everybody's in part of it, and sends our sons and daughters to their deaths so that they can make money, and the one percenters continue to grow their wealth and build their bunkers. Which is a whole other topic. Why are they building bunkers? What do they know that we don't? Right. So there's a lot of things going on that must be more that meets the eye right now.
Yeah, that's a lot of ground to cover. Interesting throwback to Smedley Butler in terms of him being one of the first, is a very early warning about the military-industrial complex, even preceding President Eisenhower's famous call out of that as the number one threat to be advised about. But in terms of Syria, the Middle East, and the rest of it, it just seems like the entire PNAC, Project for a New American Century crowd, the neocons and the neolibs who have empire in mind for the United States and will hold on to it and at all costs, even at, paradoxically, its own destruction, that policy has failed. It's failed completely and utterly. It's left dramatic destruction and the total annihilation of many different positive geopolitical relationships in its wake. And ultimately, Ross, I don't see any other way than for history in the future, God willing, to record all of the past 15 years, even 20 years going back further, as just an incredible irony and an incredible hypocrisy in terms of what the United States has been attempting to do, namely overthrow nations, control everything outside, you know, just expand the sphere of influence to the entire world. And so I think we're looking at not an end game, so to speak, in the way that these scenarios are commonly thrown around, but certainly a change. And if it goes back to something more like the Monroe Doctrine, then we actually could have the kind of global cooperation from an economic standpoint that makes sense. But ultimately, we would have to go through a cleansing process where the entire financial and monetary mechanisms are reset as well in order to begin building things from an appropriate standpoint. And with that, Ross, I think we should transition into what's going on in the bond market. There's renewed spike in yields today, and this is sort of across the board. It's not just in the U.S., it's in China, it's in other developing markets. It's all over the place. So what do we make of this move in bond yields?
I mean, I think there's a flight from bonds to, I think, and again, correct me if I'm wrong here, but there's a move from bonds and people are moving into equities because they're seeing where money's being made. Now, is that setting people up to be fleeced with this thing growing over 19,000? I think we're at 19,169 right now, up 45 on the Dow. The S&P is almost at 2,200. So is that driving it? Would you say that the money is driving from bonds into equities, and so they're having to raise the rates to get people to buy? Or what would you say is the genesis of that? Because I see a lot, I mean, as bonds decrease, the market is increasing, so I think money's flowing, like squeezing air in a balloon, right?
I think there's several different perspectives from which you can take a look at the movements in bonds and stock markets. Ultimately here, there is at some level a general idea of, okay, we're in a risk-on environment now. And that was brought on by the changing narrative after Trump's election, which kind of changed on a dime, that, oh, this, what he's talking about, the policies that he's going to implement actually require a great deal of fiscal stimulus. And that just means extra spending, extra debt, higher deficits, all this that will need to be financed. And so people are, it seems, looking at a position where debt is in oversupply, and that's going to lead to some selling there in terms of where rates are from a historical trajectory. And there's also the notion of just rebalancing from bonds into stocks, because apparently all of the headwinds that have existed forever are no longer there. And to a very real extent, I think we can take the day-to-day or even the week-to-week explanations of market moves off the table. I think that there's a profound sense in which human beings, and particularly financial news media outlets, need to come up with an explanation for why things move the way that they do, when in this day and age, the disconnect from fundamental reality and from real value is so grossly exaggerated that there's no other way to describe price setting than with the words distortion and manipulation. I mean, if you try and really unpack everything, the problem is you have all sorts of different historical relationships that typically go in one way or another, and they're going in opposite directions. I'm talking about bonds, stocks, commodities, precious metals, housing, debt, all of these kinds of different things. There doesn't seem to be any real proper explanatory rubric other than free money flow and big picture monetary policy and what's going to happen. So in the absence of the announcement of additional gratuitous central bank action to soak up some of the selling in bonds, which is occurring not just internally to the United States, but externally from countries like China and elsewhere, either directly or through their proxies, basically people don't want to hold U.S. debt because they see that in the future, much more debt has to be issued in order to keep the Ponzi scheme going. So why hold on to something that is going to be diluted or is going to lose its value, particularly when you still can get rid of it? And so we've seen this sort of dramatic boost up in yields, and some people have tried to say, oh, this is a good thing because it means that it's the Trump reflation. He's going to get everything going again, and it's going to start moving the way it should, and we're going to get back to a healthy economy. Well, the problem is the disease that we're dealing with is terminal, and so there's no way to just turn it around on a dime like that. And the disease that we're dealing with, that everybody is excited about more of, is debt itself. And so as yields go up, as the price of debt goes down, as it loses value and as the yield spike, the existing debt that's here and the constant new debt that we have to issue in order to keep our bills paid, that gets harder to pay off. Because if, you know, let's say if you go from 1% rate to a 3% rate, you just tripled the notional value of the interest expense. And so what we're staring down in the potentially not so distant future is a moment where everyone realizes that something has to go. Either the debt has to go or the currency has to go. It seems to me impossible to sustain a situation where the dollar is strengthening and strengthening and yields continue to go up and up, because it just doesn't work. The math doesn't work. So the only way to plug that gap is with fraud, manipulation, and the rest of the kind of backdoor monetary mechanisms that have been going on for the better part of a century. But that only has a certain half-life as well. So I think the bond market is signaling something where all of a sudden there may come a point where the sentiment shifts and we realize that, uh-oh, everyone is so indebted that for any further up in the rates means that nobody's going to be able to pay off their debt because of the amount of time that we've spent at zero interest rates and with rates being negative all over the world. It's just a baffling kind of situation. Whereas over the past year or so, ever since the Fed bit the bullet and went out with their first rate hike last December, people have said, oh, you know, if the stock market's good, that means that a rate hike is coming. That means that that's bad for stocks, so the stock market would go down. And then when the stock market would correct, it would be, oh, well, the market's not doing so good, so the Fed's not going to raise rates. So that means more easy monetary policy, so that provides some boost to the stock market. So we were kind of range-bound there for a very long time. But it seems that even that paradigm is broken now, where 100% rate hike is 100% good for the market. But all of this is going to turn around. The question is when, and that's a question that I don't have an answer to. But that's my view on what's happening in the bond markets. It's something to watch out for, because the U.S. has the ability to kind of just print money in a backdoor channels and pay things off, but that is not going to be able to compensate for dramatic external foreign selling by sovereign wealth funds. And as a even broader note, the rest of the countries around the world don't necessarily have the same ability. So when they're faced with adverse financial situations, they don't have the same kind of power to do what we do, namely Venezuela is a case in point where they're now weighing cash instead of counting it.
Right.
That's a classic indication of the final stages of hyperinflation. There was a 40% devaluation of the currency in 1 month, followed by a 15% devaluation in 1 day. This is now reaching the true exponential part, where big inflation turns into hyperinflation, and that's a scenario of currency destruction that we should be paying attention to because it's extremely relevant. One of these days, either the currency has to go or the debt has to go. They can't both be sustained indefinitely. And whether that will happen before Trump gets in or right after Trump gets in, or even sometime down the road, it is an inevitability, but you know, from an investing standpoint and from a preparation standpoint, it's extremely difficult to time these things. And so, you know, we would give different advice to different sorts of people with the caveat that we're not, I'm not a certified financial advisor, so I can't literally tell you what to do with your money. It's not an official, legal, you know, registered, licensed kind of advice. But I can tell you that if you're not a professional, you need to be in things that are safe and so you can sleep at night. But yeah, that's my 2 cents or maybe $2 on that one.
Oh, there you go. I mean, the hard assets prove it out in Venezuela. Those that had precious metals are probably doing well, or they had a store of toilet paper or food and things. They're faring much better than those that did not. But I think with your summation of the bond market is dead on. But I think there's also something coming that nobody's really thinking about, because we have this unnecessary or overzealous exuberance going on within the market, because we're at 19,169 or whatever, we crossed the 19,000 threshold. Everybody thinks everything's just stucky. But you look behind all that, with these raising, with the bonds, with the yields going up, that affects mortgage rates. And mortgage applications are down because the rates are cresting up over 4 and 4.5%. And so that's moving, which is still cheap money. You think about mortgages in the 80s were at 18%, or even in the early 90s, 9%. So yet 4.5, that's still pretty cheap money for a long-term mortgage. But at the same time, you have unemployment claims that came out today, a five-month high. People are, a record number of people are defaulting or behind on their auto payments. So you have, there's a lot of underlying current that really kind of starts to flash recession in front of us. And nobody's talking about that because everybody's just papering it over with exuberance of the market and everything else. And so there's things coming that nobody's really talking about, or they don't want to talk about, because I think this time between now and January 20th, there's going to be a lot of money made inside the walls of Wall Street, inside the inner circles. And then once the inauguration comes, I think we're going to start hearing, well, the recession is coming, unemployment's going up. So it'll be a self-fulfilling prophecy by the media to try to drive everybody down. I mean, I was just looking at Black Friday sales numbers, and they were way off from what they expected. So a lot of people did online things, but from an in-store perspective, people walked in. They didn't spend nearly as much as people thought they would. So Black Friday was a disappointment, which just forebodes that Christmas is not going to be that great, which again hurts the retailers, and then it plays layoffs and factory orders. So it's just a cascading effect going into January. I think you're going to see a huge change in the momentum of the country once Trump takes the oath of office, because I think there's people are laying traps for him, but he's a pretty cagey guy. He probably recognizes them, but I think there's a lot of folks in the establishment that want him to fail, and they're going to do everything they can to make him look bad for the next 4 years.
Yeah, that definitely seems to be the intention there. And from a market sentiment standpoint, it really just reinforces the notion that the only things that matter would be, at this point, monetary manipulation and just overall opinion and sentiment and expectations. Because if you look at the explanations that people use to justify things, it's heads, the market goes up, and tails, the market goes up. Oil goes down. All right, that's good for businesses and good for the consumer. So that means it's going up because gas is going to be cheaper. Oil goes up. Oh, that's good for the energy companies because they can make more profit. So that's going to drive the market higher as well. And so this kind of behavior, where no matter what the news is, it's interpreted as positive, is proof of the repetition of the irrational exuberance phenomenon that we saw at the NASDAQ top at the end of the dot-com bubble. And it really is this kind of blow-off. Could it go to 20,000 on the Dow, 21, 500,000? Like, it honestly doesn't matter, because for me, that marker is simply a placeholder in people's minds that's put there and driven to a particular place in order to construct the overarching narrative of how people should view things. And so, ultimately, when you see that kind of one-sided response from the market in terms of events, it's being driven either by total irrational exuberance or just direct manipulation. And in this case, I think we've had a little bit of both going on for the past couple of years that has particularly come to the fore at the current moment. So whether that's going to reverse and reverse hard, it's difficult to say, but there's no real fundamentals there. Just like you said, the consumer is tapped out, overly indebted. People don't have savings, they don't have access to good, high-paying jobs, or even the right kind of education to get trained up for these things. So, you know, even from a demographics perspective, the future does not look so bright in terms of the next downturn from a business cycle perspective. But, of course, the one thing I suppose that Keynes said that I agree with is that the market can remain irrational longer than you can stay solvent. So you just have to be tactical with the decisions that you make in light of this thesis, which continues to become more and more prevalent and more obvious every day if you know where to look, that the current state of affairs simply is unsustainable. The disconnects are just so dramatic. But that doesn't mean they can't get even more dramatic, because to a certain extent, it's driven on sentiment and arbitrary monetary adjustments.
Well, right. I mean, up until the election, everybody was saying, I mean, all the pundits and all the TV business folks and on MSNBC or CNBC or ABC, CBS, they were all saying, if Trump wins, the market's going to tank, the country's going to go into a hellhole. And on election night, we did see limit down of 750, but then the plunge protection team reversed that and was up 300 the next morning. So it's the manipulation is unbelievable. And to your point, the valuations of the companies and their profits and all that stuff, their ratios are way over earnings to price ratios are way too high. And then you look at it and you couple that at the same time when you're looking at some stories where 62% of Americans have less than $1,000 in their savings account, and about 62 couldn't even handle a $500 emergency spend. So that tells us, to your point, the Americans are tapped out. They don't have the money to spend, even though they're told to spend. And when our economy is 70% of our economy is driven by consumer sales, consumer spending, where do you go from there? Because you can't just do helicopter money and say, hey, everybody gets $5,000, go buy a new TV set. At what point do you have enough cheap Chinese products from Walmart that you don't need anymore? And so, again, they create new technology. Well, you have to have the latest iPhone, you have to have the latest Roku or the latest Apple TV or something like that. Folks are just pretty much tired of spending their money. They're just driven like sheep. I think Americans may be getting fed up, and I know there is a movement, albeit fairly small still, but more of a simplifying your lifestyle, a minimalist lifestyle, self-sustaining lifestyle. It's on the fringes now, but I think it's growing because people are getting fed up with being forced to buying crap that they really don't need. And then they go and sell that crap to somebody else at a garage sale, and then they go buy a new one. It's just a ridiculous cycle of spending that's unnecessary. And then you have folks that can't even eat or have fresh water, and they want you to buy a new car.
You're totally on point, Russ. There's so much negative equity in car loans being rolled over to new leases. There's so much literal hunger and starvation going on even here in the United States that the rest of the world looks at us as a total basket case. You know, we have more people on food stamps than ever, and we're less healthy, and people are poorer. It's for a large swath of the population. It really is a strange state of affairs, and it's to the point where, at the very least, in conversations that I've had with people of varying worldviews and political perspectives, we can all sort of agree that there are some very core common problems that demand a real solution. And if we're not able to come together to address those kinds of problems, even despite disagreements on the best way to go about solving them, then we're going to be in pretty serious trouble. But as we wind down here, Russ, I did want to get your take on what's going on with the precious metals. Obviously, with the dollar getting some fresh legs underneath it after the election, we've seen some fairly dramatic pullbacks in terms of the precious metal prices. And with gold going from almost up to $1,340 on election night all the way back down to the $1,160 area, it's fairly dramatic. So what should people be looking for? How should people be thinking about this? What should people be doing? Your thoughts?
Well, I think you're direct on with the notion of the strong dollar effect. Gold in dollars is way down, but if you're in India, gold in rupees is way up.
Right.
And the physical cost of gold in India these days is like $2,500. So it's not the same in all places. So again, it's the strength of the dollar is driving a lot of the price in metals. But also, people are, I think you said this at the top of the show, people are moving from safety to risk because they think, oh, happy days are here again. We're going to live in the 80s again. I've seen a lot of stories to that fact that people are saying, well, it's going to be the 80s all over again. And I don't know. I think I disagree with that. I don't think that's going to be the case at all. I think you're going to see, as I said earlier, recession fall into place and starting in the first quarter of this next year or even the second quarter. I think it's going to be manipulated and the population is going to be manipulated to start spending and create their own recession. But to your point about metals, it's a big deal on dollar, but also people are rushing to risk versus safety. And those of us that have seen it and can see Venezuela and other countries and look at then India's cash crunch and what they're doing there, with that's pure manipulation and behavior modification by the government, but that was really poorly executed. So the people are just uprising and taking bankers hostage and things like that. You know, people are going to be very upset if they try to do something like that here. There would be obviously pitchforks and ARs in the streets. But Americans, as long as they have their bread and circus like the Romans, they generally these days go along with anything that the government or the mainstream media tells them. Now, there's a cadre like yourself and I where don't listen to that drivel, and there's a lot of others and other shows that try to wake people up and tell them that's not the case. And again, all that fake news that's waking folks up that actually got Trump elected, is they're trying to pour cold water on it. So if they look at now when you see the metals going down, and you get that just exacerbates the narrative that, well, it's an old relic, you don't need it, you need to store that back with your guns and your Bibles, don't cling to it anymore. So the liberal press and all of those folks are just going to, again, just beat down the metals as best they can. But those of us that look around or are awake know that it's lasted 6,000 years. And if it's going to be a buying opportunity, but again, if you're looking for growth and you're looking for return, that may not be the place to be. But if you're looking for insurance and know that you'll always eat and always drink, that's the place to be. So it just depends on what your priorities are these days, especially.
Certainly. And we would make different recommendations to different people about portfolio allocations and different sorts of holdings depending on each person's individual circumstance. I know from my perspective, Ross, when I see the kind of waterfall manipulation selling that happens in the precious metal prices in dollar-denominated terms, then I use that as an opportunity to get a better price for the purchases. I had sort of held off on making any larger allocations with gold above $1,300 for a period of a few months and with silver up, you know, near 20 in that kind of range. But back down here, it's a better price, and so I'd take more of it. I mean, the dollar increased in value, but that's not going to stop it from ultimately losing its value. And so it's better to exchange something that's worthless for something that will actually hold its value over the long run. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you take every single liquid asset that you have and you translate it all into one gold bar and drag that around with you wherever you go. You have to be tactical and intelligent about the mechanisms that you use to deploy and take advantage of these kind of things. But ultimately, I just look at it as it's on sale. You know, it's on sale, and it's a real tangible asset that's going to preserve purchasing power. And we're looking at a situation where the purchasing power is of cash and of the dollar is not guaranteed, and perhaps the only guarantee is that the purchasing power will continue to be eroded through backdoor channels like inflation and through aggressive money printing that will be required and necessary to deal with either larger fiscal deficits or the next downturn, which is certainly long overdue and would have come a lot sooner if it weren't for various regimes of manipulation being put forward by central banks. So, you know, as we wind down here, Russ, where can people get a hold of you? Where can they see your materials, reaching out to you either at Survival 401k or at Remnant Radio Network?
Sure. You can call me at 844-650-5733 or reach out to us at survival401k.com. And there is a place that you can pop up and put a contact in, or you can even schedule a meeting with us. Also, remnantradionetwork.com, you can reach us there, or ross.powell@survival401k.com. And before we go, Steve, I just want to kind of give people another little insight is, to your point of buying it on sale, so that, let's say you want to buy a quarter-ounce gold coin, American Eagle costs you around $270 these days. Instead of buying that pair of new Nike shoes that's $270, go out and buy yourself a quarter-ounce gold coin. It's going to last you a lot longer than those shoes are. And one final thought, you can't eat gold and silver, and you can't drink it either. Or if you do, it's going to be painful on the outbound side. So I would suggest that people focus on getting food and water and things of that nature to sustain them long-term as of my parting shot, because I think that's always important and always mean to tell people that is that don't worry about gold and silver. If you don't have 3 months worth of food in your house, you need to focus on that.
Certainly true, Russ. We need to be tactical about our allocations of everything that we have in preparing for the wide variety of potentially dangerous and even bizarre situations that could find their way into reality in the near or perhaps semi-distant future. So that's very good advice for all of the listeners here, and something that I would encourage them to follow. So you guys can get a hold of Ross. Feel free to reach out to him. He's very available and is willing to give his time back to those who would reach out and ask questions or pursue any of the services that he offers at Survival 401k. So thank you all again, amateurs, for joining us on another episode of the Amateur Society. Take a look at our blog at amateursociety.wordpress.com. I'm Steven signing off. On behalf of Ross, to God be the glory.
Amen.